Hi, I'm Fola Fagbule.
And I'm Faye Fawemi.
Welcome to our podcast, where we explore the themes and ideas in our forthcoming book titled Formation, The Making of Nigeria from Jihad to Amalgamation. Formation is being published by Cassava Republic and should be available to the public from around the 1st of October 2020, inshallah. Over the next few weeks and months, we look forward to interacting with you online and hopefully in person soon.
Each episode of our podcast will focus on one theme, idea, event, or character that we covered in Formation, The Making of Nigeria from Jihad to Amalgamation. We'll also talk about how we went about doing the research and what we learned while doing so.
We hope that this podcast will serve as a useful accompaniment to Formation itself when it comes out eventually.
So, let's get started. I bid you welcome to the second episode of the Formation Podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about Usman Danfodio, a pivotal and consequential figure in the formation of Nigeria and in our book, Formation, The Making of Nigeria from Jihad to Amalgamation. But before we get to that, let's answer a couple of the messages we got from listeners to our first episode.
Hello, I'm Olu Akikugbe. This is a great conversation, and I think a podcast is an excellent idea. What I'm most excited about is the fact that your book is not likely going to be one of those history books or topics that are only accessible to university scholars and people with maybe JSTOR accounts. It looks like it's going to be accessible to an audience that wouldn't have had the time to engage with this story. So the River Niger is a great example of this kind of stories, and I've only seen that river once before, and I imagine many Nigerians are like me and never really interacted with the river. So my question is, did your book address some of the reasons why, despite the presence of a unifying feature like the Niger and events like the Jihad, the area known as Nigeria today still ended up with such a huge diversity in language and culture before the Europeans arrived?
Thank you, Olu Akinkugbe, for your comment and question, both of which are really helpful and important contributions. First, to your comment. A major reason Faye and I decided to write Formation was that we simply couldn't find Nigeria's comprehensive origin story in any easily accessible document, you know, whether in terms of language or format or medium. So what we have done is to go ourselves to all those difficult to access sources, from JSTOR to the British Library to numerous rare books and research papers by amazing Nigerian academics and historians. We've extracted the story in rich color and high definition, and then we've put the pieces together again, and we told it with additional context in a language, medium, and format that is fully accessible to modern young Nigerians. So, Olu, your comment really neatly summarizes our methodology and the reason why we wrote Formation, The Making of Nigeria from Jihad to Amalgamation. Now, secondly, to your question, which is also extremely pertinent. You know, you ask why, despite the unifying connection of the river and so many other common historical events, there was still so much diversity in the language and culture of Nigerians all the way back into ancient history. It's such an important question with a very complex answer. But the good news is that we have actually set out in this book the beginning of a coherent and comprehensive answer to this question. It begins in our opening chapter, River of Rivers, and then in the rest of the book, we continue in more detail, expanding on the theme that we set out at the start. Now, I don't want to spoil it for our readers and our listeners here, but Olu, I'd truly be excited to hear your thoughts and views again after you will have read Formation, The Making of Nigeria from Jihad to Amalgamation. I'm certain you will love it. So I think we have time for just one more question before getting to today's topic.
Hello, guys. That was a great episode. Can't wait for the next one, especially can't wait for the book. My name is Philip. It was very interesting, and I enjoyed that. I guess my only suggestion, well, I don't know if it's a question, to you guys is this. It'd be interesting if you can include a map of the body of water that you're referring to in the episode, so all the rivers and streams, if you can direct us to a link, if that's included in the book, that would be great. Direct us to a link where that we can find an accurate map of body waters across the country, now they're all connected, as it helps us to visualize some of the conversations. And you did mention quite a few rivers and streams. It would be interesting for a lot of listeners that are not aware to see that sort of such a map and how everything's connected, now they're all linked. But yeah, that's essentially my suggestion.
Thanks, Philip. That's a very good question. It's definitely in our plans and also very important because most Nigerians, including us, only have one map of Nigeria in our minds, which is the current map of Nigeria. But that map that we all know is quite recent and only came into being at the end of our story, post-1914. Before that, the story of formation is of the country being constructed piece by piece, like a jigsaw puzzle, and with the shape of the country constantly changing over that period as different people fought over different parts. So you have the Caliphate and then the Europeans made up of the British, the Germans and the French, you know, disputing different parts of it. So names of some places have also changed from what we know them to be today, which might be confusing without visual aids. So as you go on the journey with us in the book, we hope to help you, the reader, visualize each step of the journey using maps as the different parts were being added. So yes, that's something you can look forward to in formation. Thanks.
Now, back to Akpodio. The Sheikh Uthman Akpodio is the central figure in the history of Northern Nigeria and ultimately a foundational character in the evolution of Nigeria.
Yes.
In formation, we deliberately centered Akpodio as a defining character in the formation of the country, reevaluating his life and legacy in quite some detail. So I know you found this chapter so intriguing. Tell us, what new things did you learn about the life and times of the son of the Jews when we were writing this chapter of formation?
Well, that's a good question, yes. The truth is that I started from pretty much zero knowledge. And so the answer to your question is that I learned everything. You know, before we started doing this, Danfodio was just someone with a quote on the front page of the Guardian newspapers that's been there for a very long time. You know, the quote, conscience is an open wound, only truth can heal it. That was all it was to me. But when we think of Thomas Carlyle's great man theory of history, you know, we can ask ourselves how many people can be said to have truly changed history. The number will always be very small. Yeah, but I think it is safe to make the case that Danfodio altered the course of Nigerian history, whether he intended it or not. His revolution, he fired the starting gun on what we know as Nigeria today. And I think this is the central story we try to tell in the book in a way that shows it to be a lot more coherent than people realize. We cannot say for sure what the shape of Nigeria might have looked like without Danfodio's revolution. Sometimes so-called great men, they merely accelerate what was already happening. Others jump on an already moving train and take advantage of it. Would there have been a revolution without Danfodio? Maybe, maybe not. But as you know, as we show in the book, it is not as if people had not tried before him. But it took his charisma, his character, his literacy, his eloquence, his international connections, and his understanding of the political atmosphere in Northern Nigeria at the time. You know, all of these ingredients combined to make his revolution possible. In that sense, I think it was quite an interesting journey of discovery about a very consequential person, and yet now almost completely faded from memory in Nigeria.
You know, I could not agree with you more, and not just about this character, but about many of the characters that we profile all over Nigeria during that period of formation. You know, the son of Nigeria really is one of those figures in history that will remain relevant, probably for the rest of human history.
Indeed, yes. We still have some time before we go on a break, so let's take one more question, this time from Bumi.
Hi, guys. Thank you for that. So my question is based on the impact of River Niger on our cultural diversity. I would like to know if you would say categorically, based on your research, that River Niger has had the most influence on our cultural diversity as Nigerians. And I would further want to know if that was a deliberate part of a master plan to divide up the country into major ethnic groups, I mean, as we find it on the map? Or was it a community-driven outcome that wasn't deliberate, but was based on people migrating and settling in clusters along the lines of the river, and that eventually translated into us having the communities that we have today and the ethnicities that we have today?
Thanks for the question, Bumi. The first thing I'll say is that there are no definite answers, unfortunately. Nigerian history is very interesting, as we show in the book, but it's also quite complex. But let me venture some speculation, if I may. In the first episode, we talked about how the mighty river loomed large in the affairs of the people who lived around it. But we also talked about its limitations, which made it difficult for it to be an integrating force. In theory, the river connects Nigeria to Mali and several other countries in between. But in reality, you cannot travel by river between those countries. To put it in broad terms, we know that this free flow of humans from place to place initially creates diversity, but over time also reduces it when people have mixed with themselves so much and adopted each other's customs, habits, and even languages. So it was not a master plan, certainly not something anyone planned or created. But the practical reality of living around a difficult-to-navigate river created what you might call a stay-in-your-lane environment, where different groups stayed in their territory and did not really mix with each other, which of course works against the integrating process I just mentioned. In all of this, though, we cannot overlook the effect of one of the darkest periods in our history, and that is the slave trade. This went on for at least 400 years that we know of, internally, with the Arabs, and of course with the Europeans. The violent nature of slavery meant that each group was primarily organized either to defend itself against slave raiders or to raid others for slaves. Hardly anyone was organized for commerce or trade, which is the kind of relationship more likely to bring about integration. In summary, whether you were organized to attack or to defend, you had to essentially barricade yourself in. We discuss all these points in the book as well, and I hope that when you read it, it would all become clearer.
We'd like to pause here and talk a bit about why we wrote Formation, The Making of Nigeria from Jihad to Amalgamation, and why we think this story is so important.
Neither of us is trained as a historian. We both work in financial services, but we share a belief that a careful understanding of history is fundamental to navigating the future. One thing I like to say is that the past is an ongoing business. With more information, we can go back in time to edit the past. The history of Nigeria is a great example of this, as it still affects the present. And if we don't understand it, the future is guaranteed to look just like the past.
Exactly. My biggest hope for Formation is that it provides a nuanced and thoughtful starting point for many future journeys into the history of our culture, politics, and economics. We also hope that it begins a conversation that will help navigate a more advantageous future for the humans of Nigeria.
And that's my hope too. Let's get back to the podcast.
Before the break, we talked a bit about Danfodio and his incredible historical significance to Northern Nigeria and ultimately to the formation of the modern country, Nigeria. So let's be a bit more specific now. Feyi, to your mind, what are the most commonly misunderstood or least known facts about the Sheikh and his influence in the formation of modern Nigeria? For me personally, it was a couple of things. First, I was intrigued to learn, as you've already pointed out in your earlier response, that Danfodio was not the first revolutionary Islamic preacher to emerge from the old Hausa city-states. As we show very well in Formation, he would also not be the last. His revolution just happened to be the one that was the best organized and succeeded in upending the existing world order. Wonder what the country would look like if any of the prior or even some of the later ones succeeded just as spectacularly. Secondly, I was struck by the fact that this man was essentially a middle-class intellectual revolutionary in the context of his time. You know, Danfodio was a comfortable, protected, privileged member of the leadership elite in the pre-jihad Hausa country before he led the process of, as we say these days, scattering everything.
that's one of the biggest surprises, you know. Like, as you mentioned, he was not always a revolutionary. There was a specific point in time when he changed strategy. We showed this in the book. So when he switched from
He's more, if you like, pacifist strategy to a more to more revolutionary methods, you know. But before that, he was a member of the elite, as you say. And he had a useful, if delicate, relationship with the ruling class. He advised them. He was pretty much a member of the courts, as someone they felt they needed to keep close due to his large and devoted following, which they viewed as a threat. Ultimately, these delicate relationships are they are hardly sustainable in the long term. You know, it is difficult to be close to the ruling elite while at the same time providing comfort to the masses who are the victims of that same elite. Ultimately, you'll be forced to pick a side, which is what he did. His genius, however, was in the timing of when he chose to make his move. He wasn't the first to try. Again, we've said this before. And even his own legacy will be at the receiving end of many such revolutionary attempts, you know, while he was alive and even long after he was dead, as we show in the book. You know, but his success was unmatched by any other revolution. You know, I mean, the facts are clear on that. You know, we can. So I think for me, ultimately, you know, I put this down to timing, as I said earlier, and the incredible devotion due to his own personal character and personal probity. You know, that devotion he inspired in his mass of followers, the Jama, if you like. Yeah.
Fascinating. Well, I really hope that our readers will learn as much as we did from the writing process. So let's talk a bit now about legacy, which you already started referring to, you know, and modern reality. How important do you think Danfodio still is today in the modern world? Also, what does the current state of scholarship and followership of the original caliph say to you about the future of Nigeria? You know, I'll start. Personally, I have to say that I was a bit disappointed at the level of scholarship outside of northern Nigeria and Britain. On Danfodio and on the original caliphate, and also the extent to which the core leadership values of this truly impressive leader have failed to translate in any reasonable way into modern Nigeria. One of the more profound lessons for me from writing Formation with you was just how the quality of leadership in the caliphate declined precipitously after the first two sultans. And this is something we'll talk a bit about more in subsequent episodes. But, you know, it really has never recovered to its founding heights. I found that very interesting.
Yeah, that's something we show quite in the book, you know, and the quote that comes to mind when I was, you know, when we're reading and researching that part of the story was Kevin Spacey said at the beginning of American Beauty, you know, this will be the high point of my day. From here, it all goes downhill. So you know, once you get past the trinity of Danfodio himself as the visionary, his brother Abdullahi as the lawmaker and constitutionalist, and his son Mohammed Bello as the one who turned the vision into reality, the trajectory was downwards. If listeners would permit me a football analogy, you know, so Danfodio was the deep lying midfield visionary, you know. So you can say an Andrea Pirlo. He never really got into the box, but he was one spraying the passes and dictating the play. Abdullahi was the box to box midfielder. So when the team is under attack, he joins the defense. When the team is attacking, he joins the attack. So it's kind of like an N'Golo Kante, if you like. And then Mohamed Bello was the one who was the attacking force, you know, the central striker. You can say, I don't know, like Karim Benzema, for example. So those three, you know, maybe they were one-offs, you know, and maybe we're asking too much for those who came after them to match them, you know. But again, you know, for that question is something we're happy to leave for to the readers of Formation, for them to decide for themselves what they think about that. You know? But to your question of the importance of Danfodio, if for nothing else, we're a country almost without memory. You know, a lot of our stories hidden in out of print books and long forgotten books. I mean, this is something we discovered, you know, when, you know, trying to get into that part of history can be time consuming and expensive. This is just for the last two centuries. If we go back further, you know, so much is lost to the mist of time. You know, we don't know what happened in those days. You know, it cannot be good for any country, let alone a country like Nigeria, that is still struggling to make some sense of itself and find its place in the world, both for its citizens and globally generally. So Danfodio is a quote-unquote victim of that general lack of memory. Whether we choose to remember him for good or for ill, The important thing is that we have to remember him, and we've not done a good job of that.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I was less, you know, disappointed by inaccurate coverage of Danfodio and of the original caliphate as I was about just the absolute lack of coverage, you know, because inaccurate coverage can be corrected, which is part of what we set out to do in formation. But, you know, the lack of coverage is really detrimental.
Yeah. Just to add something to what you're saying, you know, one mm-hmm. of the things we tried to do was we tried to find physical characteristics of characters that we included, mm-hmm. just so people can mm-hmm. have a kind of connection with them, you know, so we're able to tell people how tall Mungo Park is, you know, we can describe some people in both. For Danfodio, it's very difficult. It's kind of difficult to find any defining. I mean, mm-hmm. The only thing I think we could find was, okay, the kind of clothes he wore. But, you know, those clothes mm-hmm. were not unique to him. So, you know, just to buttress your point that, yes, the mm-hmm. lack of information is a bit galling. And I guess part of it might be because of the way the history was written. So mm-hmm. these guys were, the leaders of the caliphate were pretty much the only literate people around. So mm-hmm. they were able to write their own history. They tried to be objective in some cases, like Mohammed Bello, you know, but the bottom line of the matter is that, you know, beyond the leadership of the caliphate and then maybe El Kanemi in Borno, you know, there wasn't really any literacy, widespread literacy. So all we know about them, they wrote by themselves.
Yeah, that's such a good way to put it. You know, I think I speak for both of us when I say that our sincerest hope is that formation, the making of Nigeria from jihad to amalgamation, will help begin the process of peering into the mist of time, as you call it.
Indeed.
You know, and relearning these stories, you know, the beginning of a conversation rather than the end of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so I think this is all the time we have for today. Next week, we will continue our story by moving into the economic, political, and cultural aftermath of the jihad. It's a very fascinating story in another episode of our podcast, and it will be covering the chapter that we titled Caliphate in Session. Should be fun.
Indeed.
So that's it for today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast for our book Formation, The Making of Nigeria from Jihad to Amalgamation, being published by Cassava Republic and available to the world from around the 1st of October 2020, inshallah. We would love to hear from you. You can leave us a voice message at anchor.fm/Nigeria Formation/message. This link is also in the podcast notes. Please leave your name and where you live in the voice message. We will play it and answer your question in the next episode. You can also continue the conversation with us on Twitter by tagging our handles @FF and @FolaFagbule.
You can also get more information and updates online at www.nigeria-formation.com. Please sign up if you haven't already done so and spread the word to your friends and family as well. We look forward to speaking with you again soon about formation.